Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Pentagon officials are confirming that U.S. forces came close to capturing insurgent leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi last February, but they did get his computer, and with it a treasure trove of information. Zarqawi has had a hand, at times a personal hand, in many of the beheadings, suicide bombings, and guerrilla raids that have plagued American forces and the Iraqi government since the fall of Saddam Hussein. Joining us with details is Faye Bowers, national security correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Faye, we understand that this almost operation took place February 20th, and at the time, Iraqi officials suggested Zarqawi had almost been captured. But apparently these new reports have more details. What happened that day?
That's right. Apparently, you know, U.S. officials or possibly Iraqi officials were tipped off that Zarqawi was on his way to a meeting with, you know, his fellow insurgents in Ramadi. That's a town kind of west of Baghdad, and he had been housed in Fallujah at the time, is where he was holed up and where U.S. officials believed he was. Anyway, they had set up some checkpoints along the way, and as one car approached the checkpoint, apparently this truck peeled off from behind with U.S. military officials in pursuit. But when they pulled the truck over, Zarqawi wasn't in it. So they later determined that he must have jumped out at like some kind of underpass and hid under there before escaping.
And what made them think he was in the truck in the first place?
Because it took off as it approached the checkpoint.
And because of what they found, his personal computer?
That's right. Apparently, they found his computer with, you know, one military official told me this morning, a treasure trove of information. And I think, you know, intelligence officials have told me in the past that, you know, that's more important almost to them than capturing an al-Qaeda operative, because in the past when they've captured these guys, they haven't been so talkative in interrogations. But on their computers, they never expect outside eyes to see this material. So the intelligence officials believe that's almost more important than catching a person.
In material including, I just have to note, a file on his computer called My Photos, complete with pictures of him. His driver, his bodyguard were also there, $100,000 in euros, and little mini hard drives, those flash drives that you can buy for about $30, telling us what about their operation?
Well, I think it tells us more about their technological capabilities, although I think, you know, intelligence officials had figured this out in the past. They know these guys are really adept with computers and other high technological equipment, and that they use those to, you know, correspond with their, you know, recruits, with their fellow cadres, with you know, between groups, between, you know, Zarqawi's group in Iraq and Osama bin Laden, for example, in Afghanistan. Mm. And they carry these things in such, you know, they're so small, as we all know, we use them, the Blackberries, the Palm Pilots, whatever, that you think, you know, if they don't capture you, they're not going to capture this equipment. But just sort of leaving your computer on the seat like that was apparently a major mistake.
Well, now, it was thought that Zarqawi was one-legged, which raises questions about him, you know, jumping from a moving truck and then making his way away. Do you and your sources believe the story that he escaped?
You know, I think it's possible, and sources are telling me, as a matter of fact, I spoke with a very high-level military official this morning, an advisor to John Abizaid, the commander in charge of all troops in Iraq, and he told me that they came extraordinarily close to capturing him in late February. And so, yeah, I believe that they did, but the stories about the two legs about him possibly having only one leg are kind of funny in a way, sad in another, in that intelligence officials early on, you know, in their eavesdropping efforts, had heard discussion of him having treatment for a missing leg in Iraq, and that turned out, I think, over a year ago. Intelligence officials kind of backed off that story that he had that. But again, this morning I was told that, you know, by Jordanian sources are saying that on the computer was a lot of information about Zarqawi's current medical condition, that he was being treated for a stomach wound.
No, well, we'll have to see. We'll keep an eye on that. Faye Bowers covers national security for the Christian Science Monitor. Faye, thanks as always.
Okay, my pleasure.
Turning now to the world of finance, Time magazine's recently released special issue, The Time 100 Most Influential People in the World, featured just one person from finance, Boston-based Amy Dominy, one of the founders and leaders of the world of socially responsible investing. This past weekend, several of Amy's friends gathered to salute her, including Tim Smith of Walden Asset Management.
Amy is really a pioneer. For example, this year, the Dominy Social Investment Fund has been one of the leaders in sponsoring shareholder resolutions with companies. So they've been asking, for example, companies to disclose where they made their political contributions.
Amy Dominy came up with the idea of an index for socially responsible companies 30 years ago. She was convinced that she could do as well financially as other leading indexes while requiring that companies also do good. In 1984, she wrote the book on the topic, Ethical Investing, and had many early fans, including stockbroker Julie Goodrich.
I just thought, that's it. I've got to do socially responsible investing. So I called her up that minute, and she came that afternoon.
Amy Dominy became both financial guru and matchmaker. She later introduced Julie to a philanthropist named Hillary. The two eventually became lead plaintiffs in the landmark Massachusetts gay marriage lawsuit. It's one of the many illustrations of the odd reach of Amy's influence.
And she spoke at your wedding as well.
She did an amazing job speaking at our wedding. And, you know, Amy is just a couple years older than I am, and she was one of the people who really taught me that you can be a grown-up and not compromise your politics.
My name is Pierre Imbert. I have had the privilege to serve on a community development loan fund for Haiti with Amy. She has almost single-handedly powered the community development loan fund. What a gift she's been for us, for all the little peoples of the world.
Now, Amy Dominy has her critics. For instance, some object to the fact that McDonald's makes her list. But Amy says her index is for companies open to dialogue and change. McDonald's has switched to eggs from free-range chickens. Maybe free-range chicken McNuggets are next. Well, Amy Dominy joins us in the studio now with more. Welcome.
Thank you.
And congratulations.
Well, thank you. It was a thrill. But what it really tells me is that socially responsible investing is having an impact.
Well, in fact, as noted in Time magazine, the assets of social investing funds have swelled to $36 billion, more than double that of 3 years ago. And the trend began after you primarily launched it. You weren't the only one, but certainly have become the mother of the movement. You've heard that before.
I have.
What exactly is it?
Socially responsible investing? Well, we consider it to be three components. Buying better companies, or what I would say is applying standards to the companies we buy. The second component is more tactical, and that is we enter into direct dialogue with companies we own shares in and ask them to make improvements that help the lives of people. A recent example would be we were part of a dialogue that led to Procter & Gamble committing itself to purchasing fair trade coffee. Yeah. A third component is support for community economic development through investing directly in some of the grassroots organizations that make loans to poor people.
Could you tick off the things you absolutely won't invest in?
Alcohol, tobacco, gambling, nuclear power, military weapons are absolute drop-dead standards for us. We do not invest in the manufacturers of these products. However, there are a number of areas where we find we're unable to invest fully because of other factors. Big oil. I don't have a screen to drop dead on oil, but none of the big oil companies meet any of the basic human rights or basic environmental standards. I haven't had a reason to rush into the for-profit prison system. If you look at the human rights implications of for-profit prisons, it's pretty hard to imagine a scenario under which I would purchase such a company.
Let me stop you, though, and ask about nuclear power. Given the energy crisis, isn't nuclear power, a power of the future to look into?
There's quite a lot of concern over the proliferation, possibly, of nuclear weapons, and how do these weapons get into the hands of people who will use them as weapons of mass destruction against populations.
But how much do investors make when they invest socially responsibly? How does it compare?
Well, on balance, the social funds, when apples-to-apples comparisons are made, you do have a slight outperformance on the side of the social funds. My own fund is an index fund, and I'm sorry to say the last 5 years I have not had that kind of a track record. We don't buy big oil, and big oil is very important in the S&P, which is my own benchmark. But the other large-cap growth funds in the social investment space have had very good years, even in recent history.
Yeah, it has been pointed out that in recent years, oil, weapons production, we were at war, all of those investments have done very well. You don't invest in those kinds of companies. You've, in fact, did phenomenally well during the tech boom because high-technology companies tend to be more socially responsible. But is that the danger of social responsible investing, that it limits?
In certain kinds of markets, that's going to hurt. In a market where oil is the only game in town, that's going to hurt. I think the economy now is reverting to basic economic standards, that we've survived this oil bulge, and now we're beginning to return to a business-as-usual environment.
And still, with your index lagging behind, let's say, the S&P or the Vanguard, we put some numbers together, and for instance, Time reports that your fund has risen 9.8% a year, just shy of the 10.4% gain in the Vanguard 500 fund. But if you do the math, that's maybe, let's say, you're lucky enough to have $100,000 that you've invested. That's only maybe $600 a year difference.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing a lot of your clients would pay $600 a year to know that their investments were good ones.
Yes, indeed. And I don't think anybody knows what next year is going to hold.
How did this all start?
Well, I got involved in the field of ethical investing as a result of being a retail stockbroker in Harvard Square. I had clients who would listen to me very politely and then tell me, "Are you kidding? I'd never buy a coal company." Now, this was at a time when we were beginning to learn about South Africa. The train of events was that in 1971, the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, answering the cry of pain from the Anglican sister church in South Africa, traveled to the General Motors annual meeting and asked that country to get out of South Africa. A newly elected African-American preacher, a newly elected board member of General Motors, stood up and said, "A corporation can make a difference, and I'm going to make a code of conduct, a set of principles for doing that, and we'll track our progress." His name was the Reverend Leon Sullivan, and he constructed simple questions. How many blacks supervise how many whites? Do they share the same cafeteria? Civil society became engaged. State of New Jersey divested of South African stocks. City of Cambridge stopped buying Ford cars for their police force or IBM typewriters for their city hall. That is a path that we've followed ever since. And in fact, it turned out that investors were credited by Nelson Mandela as giving him the single most important tool he had in ending apartheid. Well, this was a tremendously energizing statement, and it made me feel that if we were going to agree that investments we make today shape the world we live in tomorrow, then what are we looking for out of those investments? It's very simple. It comes down to people and the planet. We want the planet to survive. We want universal human dignity. So we began to apply standards that would tell Wall Street and tell actual management at companies that there were investors that looked at issues impacting the lives of people and the environment. That kind of took off.
Amy Dominy, one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People of the Year, will continue our conversation on socially responsible investing in a minute. Much more coming up here and now. Robin Young, It's Here and Now, and we've been speaking with Amy Dominy, money manager and one of the top forces behind socially responsible investing. She's just been listed in Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People. And Amy, you've said corporations are now more important than governments. They're certainly wealthier than some countries. And globalization has made it even harder to track where your investment money goes.
Yeah, sure. The conventional way of buying stocks is to have an analyst say to five oil companies, "How are you going to increase your profits?" The best answer for an oil company is going to be, "I'm going to increase my profits because I have a better way of getting oil cheaper." And you sitting at home thinking that you're the shepherd of your assets don't know that you just put 10,000 people in chains in Burma. But you did. by the very fact that you failed to ask how they were doing that, how they were making that profit. You trusted some entity in the sky to say, oh, we wouldn't do that kind of thing. But guess what? It happens hundreds of thousands of times every day.
How do you, Amy Dominy, guarantee that they won't? I mean, how do you go about your process? Obviously, there are going to be some companies that are all for it. They're transparent and they're already thinking the way you are. But how do you find out what companies are really doing?
To get a corporation or even an individual to buy into the concept that they can do better, there's an idea in the Catholic Church of closer to thee, my Lord. I like to think of that. Mm-hmm. You can do a little better, but we do it ourselves through two basic mechanisms. When we do research on a company, we send, it's about a 40-page audit of the company, and we say, this is what we know about you. What do you think about that?
Give me an idea. Like, what are some of the things you ask?
Well, we consider certain industries to be high risk. Garment industry or making toys is a high risk industry. So you can point out to a Disney corporation that there's a weakness in their social audit based on the fact that they're manufacturing toys overseas in China and in other at-risk situations. They will then respond to us and say, we want you to know what we're doing to assure that there is not abuse of the workforce in these locations. And that response will go into the profile and improve their rating on that issue. Now, the second thing we do is direct dialogue. So we can enter into a conversation with, for instance, a McDonald's and ask them about where they buy their chickens and whether or not those chickens have had what you and I might consider a shot at a life. If McDonald's responds, which they did, they're in a way revolutionized the chicken industry. They're the biggest purchaser in the whole world of chickens.
It's just a little shift, but the shifts add up. Amy Dominy, the Dominy 400 Social Index, we understand the companies that get on it have to answer correctly on 140 issues ranging from toxic waste fines to diversity in top management. Can you give me an example of a company that maybe didn't make the first cut but then made some adjustments and then got on the index?
We've had an interesting history back and forth with IBM. IBM, when we launched the index, was in the military business and was in South Africa. They asked us, what would it take to get on the Dominy Index? And we said, that's easy. You just need to stop being a military contractor and get out of South Africa. Well, in fact, over the next few years, I don't think it was as a result of desperate desire to be on the Dominy Index, but they did get out of South Africa and they did get out of the military contracting. We added them to the index at that point. Then they had to pay an $11 million fine for having violated a State Department decree. They had asked for permission to sell a supercomputer to the Russian military. They had been denied and they had sold it anyway. That got them kicked back off the index. Now they're, I would say, a company that's getting increasingly interesting to us.
The social responsibility and making change is obviously an important part of it. You're not against making money.
Oh, no. I am an investor, so I am looking for something to invest in. I believe quite strongly that the power of finance is the single strongest power on the planet. I sometimes remember those cowboy shows when I was growing up. There was a stagecoach or a wagon, and something happened to cause the horses to panic, and, you know, it was disaster. And then Cowboy Bob or Jim or Bill would come over the tundra or mountain pass and reach that lead horse and bring it to some place. I feel that finance is charging ahead without destination, carrying on board helpless the family of humankind. And Cowboy Bob can't be government. Finance is bigger, ran over Argentina when it wanted to. It can't be enlightened consumers, not as long as more people smoke today than yesterday. I'm not going to count on the consumer. I believe that Cowboy Bob has got to be some component of finance itself, some infiltration into the belly of the beast that leads it to understand that it must also, as it's making money, must also be building a better tomorrow.
Amy Dominey, and we haven't really touched on social issues. I know you're concerned about many, including AIDS in Africa. So as we leave you, how do corporations play a role there?
You may not think of Coca-Cola as an answer to AIDS, but they are selling an awful lot of Coke in that continent, and shareholder activists have engaged that company very successfully to find solutions to this epidemic, not because they're in the drug industry, but simply because this is their customer base, and they owe it to their customer base to try to do something about it. And it's not Coke's fault that AIDS exists. It's not Coke's fault that drugs are expensive. They just happen to be the deep pockets in that corner of the world.
So they're going to hear from Amy Dominey.
They have.
Amy, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Okay, thank you.
Amy Dominey of Dominey Social Investments, one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People of the Year. And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, 30 years ago this week, the city of Saigon fell. We'll speak to those who were there, an American Marine and a Vietnamese man still living in Da Nang. Also, reality TV can turn anyone into a star for at least 15 minutes, but what happens when your fame meter runs out? We'll talk to the authors of The 16th Minute. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Senate has opened hearings into Social Security reform just as the White House announces an extension of the national tour to promote the president's ideas for Social Security. President Bush is facing a tough sell. Polls show his plan to partially privatize the program is losing popular support. In fact, the president's aides, most notably Karl Rove, have steered him into a series of unpopular decisions lately, including intervening in the bitter family struggle over extending the life of Terry Schiavo. Wayne Slater is senior political writer at the Dallas Morning News. He's been following George W. Bush and Karl Rove since they appeared on the political stage more than a decade ago. And Wayne spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes.
Wayne, let's start by getting you to describe Karl Rove's involvement right now in policy at the White House in the overhaul of Social Security, in the Terry Schiavo case. His hands are all over these things, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, that is his job. His job, sort of officially codified as deputy chief of staff now, is to formally drive the politics of the policy that is the White House positions on things like Social Security and Terry Schiavo. Karl Rove's genius is his ability to deliver politically on whatever George Bush says he wants in terms of policy. Now, that's what he's doing inside the White House.
Wayne, Karl Rove might be the political genius in the White House, but I'm wondering how much does the president miss his other longtime key advisor, Karen Hughes, who's basically gone home to Texas to be with her family, although she does consult the president apparently from time to time. How much does he miss her in relation to her being a counterbalance to Rove and miss her in relation to keeping the president in touch with the public?
Enormously. Karen Hughes and Karl Rove have been historically the two closest figures whispering in the ear of George Bush. And what you've seen in the case of Social Security, where Bush may have extended himself politically beyond his ability to perform on the policy issue, and in Terry Schiavo, where he flew back to the White House to sign the bill at a time when really the polls have suggested that even some of his social conservatives weren't too hot about the idea, really show that while Karl pushes policy, puts together constituency groups, is really driven by the politics, the pure politics and the political game, Karen was always there to say, wait a minute, what's the big picture? What's the big message?
What's the payoff?
That's it. How will people respond?
Okay, let's talk about policy today. Today, in fact, we're hearing reports that the president is going to extend his Social Security roadshow, even as some Republican lawmakers like South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham are saying the president should change his focus, and the polls indicate declining public support for Social Security overhaul. Yesterday, however, Karl Rove had this to say about Social Security to the editorial board at USA Today.
It's important to look at what has happened in this first phase, which is that there's a pretty widespread recognition now that this is an important problem facing the country that ought to be dealt with by Congress now.
Wayne Slater, given the fact that public support for overhauling Social Security is on the decline, what's going on here in Karl Rove's head?
Well, I mean, there are a couple of things. One is driving the policy that the president wants. The president wants this change in Social Security, not only because of solvency, but more importantly, and this is what we've heard about, this concept of private accounts. In Karl's mind, which is an enormously gifted mind, he sees in the change in Social Security and the movement toward private accounts, and that's the big stumbling block right now, he sees a fundamental change, the end of the last vestige of the Roosevelt New Deal. And it's not an understatement to say that's part of his thinking in this. The problem is when you deal with something that has historically been impossible for any administration to change significantly because of the political lightning strikes that it draws, then it's by its very nature very difficult. And frankly, some people are asking, has Karl Rove and George Bush, have they reached too far?
Well, let me ask you that question. Has the master strategist Karl Rove overreached?
You know, I've watched this guy, as I said, for years, and every time it looks like he's in trouble, and he's not infallible. He made mistakes in 1997 when Bush was governor and came out in strong support for a tax and education plan in Texas, which failed. But he then seized on this partial success of it to help drive his presidential campaign. He was wrong in 2000 about the New Hampshire primary. He was wrong in 2004 about the final vote. He's not always right. But time after time, I see Karl pushing a policy, pushing a candidate, pushing an agenda with this marvelous ability to assemble constituency groups just enough to get some modicum of victory, and he wins. Carl said the other day at a speech at Washington College that, you know, his critics and the media and others were so bullish about criticizing him, saying that the White House failed or would fail on No Child Left Behind. It was stymied many, many times. The president was ultimately successful with the passage there. I've watched this guy so long, I'm loath to say that he's going to lose, although it doesn't look very good at the moment for Social Security.
Does Karl Rove ever decide to just throw in the towel?
That's not his style. But again, he lost in 1997, and that's a good object lesson. The president, when he was governor of Texas, lost on a very big policy decision, the most significant sort of initiative of his entire political life up to that point, about education and taxes in Texas. And what happened was, even though they lost in the Senate and House of Texas, they took what they could claim, respun it, and made it a victory. The question is, if Social Security reform fails, Rove also is looking to the 2006 and 2008 elections. And what is it? What message can you take out of this? Recalcitrant Democrats, questions that you try to appeal to the base. What can you take out of it that will be to your benefit in those subsequent years politically? It's not a victory, but it's a partial victory, and that's what we've seen in the past.
Do you think that Karl Rove is worried or bothered by the recent polls, which show the approval rating for his boss, President Bush, down to just 45%, with 49% actually disapproving of his performance as president right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's concerned about it. I mean, worried is probably too strong. The one thing that was absolute surety, as I've watched this guy over the years, is that he would say publicly in front of cameras, let's not worry about polls and focus groups and so forth, and privately, I have never seen anyone in public life, in political life, so consumed by polls and focus groups. I think, though, he sees them realistically as snapshots at a moment in time and understands that the race is long and that there are ways to survive.
Wayne Slater, thanks.
Good to be with you, Bob.
Wayne Slater is a senior political writer at the Dallas Morning News. He's also co-author of the book Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. Wayne spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes. still to come. 150 years of the Broadway musical. Well, we won't hear all of it, but Here and Now's theater critic Bill Marks commiserates with the author of The Rise and Fall of Broadway, future Gershwins and Sondheims. Where are you? You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. Our story on the Crime Stopper program that pays school kids to snitch on their classmates who are involved in illegal activity prompted this note from Thomas Marcello, a student at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge. He writes, "From the perspective of someone who has sold drugs in high school, I feel my insight into the subject may be helpful. What will be gained by creating an incentive-based system of snitching in schools? Will this system all of a sudden stop drug dealing and usage within the student body? No. When there is demand, supply will be met. Snitches will inevitably be exposed. High school kids can't keep secrets. Snitching violates the most sacred norm of the drug culture, and snitches are often beaten, tortured, and killed. I'm appalled that kids are being exploited to further an already failed war on drugs." Our conversation about the problem of violence by parents against teachers got a lot of response. This from AP in Gilbertsville, Pennsylvania. She writes, "I do not condone violence of any kind against anyone. However, one of the reasons parents may feel frustrated is that they do not feel they're being heard. When school administrators and teachers talk with parents about their kids, they often seem to forget that they're talking to a parent, usually a person who loves that child more than life itself. My son has autism. His first year in a regular classroom was terrible. Time and again, we would have to sit in meetings with our son's teachers and listen while people would describe him as violent and horrible. I spent many times in these meetings crying, and I can easily see how some parents could lose control. My husband and I did not lose control. We went the legal route and brought an advocate with us the next time, and that changed everything. It's sad that it took that." Well, we get many calls. This one from Ed of Mesa, Arizona.
I was tremendously upset about the piece that you ran regarding the high school kids who are illegal immigrants to our country who were competing in the robotics competition. I listened to a lot of NPR, but I have to tell you that I was tremendously insulted by your glamorization of people who are in our country illegally, who should not be here, who should not be attending school, who should not be using the resources of legal citizens. I do enjoy your program, but I found that piece so offensive that this is actually the first time in probably 15 years of listening to NPR that I have ever called. Thank you.
Well, Ed's call prompted us to call Josh Bernstein of the National Immigration Law Center. And Josh, tell us, why were those young people, high schoolers from West Phoenix, Arizona, as illegal immigrants, allowed to go to public schools?
Remember, these kids have come here through no fault of their own. They've grown up here. They're, you know, basically Americans. They know this country more than they know the country where they came from. And also, they're here to stay. So we're actually better off if they're educated.
But right now, is it legal for them to be in public school?
Absolutely. The Supreme Court has said that it's wrong to punish children for the actions of their parents, and that young people who are brought here through no fault of their own can't be discriminated against in education.
But now that they've become public, you indicated, well, they're here to stay, but is it possible they might be deported?
Yeah, some 5,000 are deported every year, 5,000 children. And if they do come to the attention of the authorities, and these young people have definitely put themselves in danger by giving their information, they could well be deported. These are obviously really smart kids who have a lot to contribute. If they're deported, then the country that they're deported to is going to be the one that's going to benefit from their talent.
Josh Bernstein of the National Immigration Law Center. Josh, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
We also got a phone call from a listener in New Jersey interested in some of the music we played in the show after our segment on the administration of Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Well, the song is called Health and Fitness by the band Robert Walters' 20th Congress. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Lennon, the musical, based on former Beatle John Lennon, is set to open this summer on The Great White Way. That show will open just blocks from All Shook Up, a musical that's based on the hits of Elvis Presley, Mamma Mia, the smash hit based on the songs of ABBA, and Billy Joel's Movin' Out. Skeptics say Broadway is turning into a giant musical jukebox. They long for the days of
Camelot, Camelot. I know it sounds a bit bizarre, but in Camelot, Camelot, that's how conditions are.
In the new book, The Rise and Fall of the Broadway Musical, author Mark Grant looks at Broadway's 150-year history, and when Here and Now's theater critic Bill Marks had the chance to speak with him, the two commiserated.
I want to tell you that it's gratifying to read a book like yours. There are so many books out now that are talking about Broadway's history, somehow suggesting that the great days are still here and are in the future. And it seems to me that your book really analyzes why the great days of Broadway may be over.
Well, my take on the last 150 years history of the Broadway musical sees three eras. The first era starts right after the Civil War with The Black Crook, which is generally considered to be the first musical, and extends until approximately the mid-1920s when we have Showboat, which is considered the first great musical of the Golden Age.
Oh, listen, sister, I love my Mr. Mail, and I can't tell you why. There ain't no reason why I should love that man.
And for 40 years, we have the era of the Rodgers and Hammerstein, Lerner and Lowe, Cole Porter, Gershwin Brothers, Kurt Weill, etc., writers who created the repertoire of our musical theater's literature for the most part. Then from 1966 or so on to today, we have what I submit is the Third Age. And I see many alarming similarities between the Third Age and the First Age. The First Age concentrated on spectacle at the expense of sense quite often. I submit that we've come full circle to that in many of the characteristic musicals of the last 20 or 30 years, with some signal exceptions like Stephen Sondheim.
Someone to make you come through, who'll always be there, as frightened as you of being alive.
What do you think happened? I mean, we had Showboat in Oklahoma. You love a musical like Finnegan's Rainbow.
That's the time things will come your way on that great, great come and get day.
Those shows are long gone. Instead, we have shows like Mamma Mia.
Yes, you're right. The Broadway musical theater throughout its history has always to some extent reflected the popular music, the leading-edge popular music of the overall culture. And as I point out in my book, in the First Age, that was the march, and secondarily the waltz. Then you come to the advent of the ballroom dancing craze around the First World War and the foxtrot became the basis for the Broadway songbook in the Golden Age. Now we have the rock groove, and the shows that you mentioned tend to be of the genre that I and other people have called jukeboxicals. They're assemblages of the song catalogs of the writers that are identified with the rock era.
Ever since I was a young boy, I've played the silver ball. From Soho down to Brighton, I must have played them all. But I ain't seen nothing like him in any amusement hall. That deaf, dumb, and blind kid, so blazing.
And there is an artificial attempt to create a new book that gives the semblance of a traditional musical to link the songs, or there's a choreographic arrangement such as Twyla Tharp's of Billy Joel's songs in Movin' Out. But we had this kind of thing back in 1900 and 1910 with a man named Arthur Voglin, who was the general director of New York's Hippodrome Theater, where he came up with a production concept, which was very superficial, and everybody wrote to the concept. It wasn't really based on a compelling story idea or compelling dramatic idea. It was about spectacle. And what was the purpose of going to the theater was to have live entertainment. Now we go to hear live canned entertainment. And the Broadway Theater is a kind of Las Vegas in New York, Las Vegas on the Hudson.
What gives a girl power and punch? Is it charm? Is it boys? No, it's hairspray.
Although I agree with much of what you're saying. I mean, obviously, you're open to the charge that, well, we've always had people talking about the golden age and Broadway was never what it used to be.
Sure.
Broadway has continued. There are still people coming and seeing musicals. And on the horizon, you never know what might be coming along that might reinvigorate the form, and that you're basically, you know, saying that it's dead when it's not dying. It will evolve into something great again.
Well, I certainly hope so. One of the things I want to make clear that there were some terrible musicals produced in what I'm calling the second or golden age. And there were some wonderful pieces that were done in the third age. I think The Who's Tommy was a very interesting piece of musical theater, for instance. I think that Dreamgirls was a wonderful musical based on Motown and rhythm and blues. So I'm not ruling out any of these idioms.
And I am telling you, I'm not going. You're the best man I'll ever know. There's no way I can ever go.
Reading your book, I must admit I didn't see many glimmers of hope. So let me ask you, do you see any glimmers of hope given the fact that we're in this this mode of recycling previous material, previous pop tunes?
I think that one of the things that has to change is to reinvigorate the tradition, we have to get away from the concept that a musical must be an adaptation of an already existing property. But that's impossible to do. We're in a vicious circle situation because the cost of production being so expensive, producers are only going to put on and investors are only going to invest in the tried and true property, whether it's a movie like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels or a well-known rock musician like Elvis Presley or John Lennon or whatever, because that's the only kind of product that will have a hint of a promise of return of such an exorbitant investment. So we're sort of locked in.
The minute you walked in the joint, I could see you were a man of distinction, a real big spender.
And theater is live. Theater is the magic of illusion and suggestion. And it sometimes requires an absence of special effects and an absence of loud noise to make its effect. And we still get that in fringe or off Broadway venues and some regional theaters, but when people come to Broadway musicals, that's not what they're coming to see now, and it's regrettable.
Mark Grant, author of The Rise and Fall of the Broadway Musical, spoke with Here Now's theater critic Bill Marks. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.